so let's talk about mediated communication.
I would say that once again, I stole most of the slides from Nicolas Roussel, but he was my former student, so I am unashamed.
And he allowed me to do it.
Okay, so we're talking about communication today. So how do you communicate?
Do you use email?
Yes, is there a voice for writing or by using a software?
How do you communicate? I do all of them, but
you
I prefer face-to-face and mail. You
prefer face-to-face and mail?
Yeah.
Okay, you don't like phone?
I don't like phone. I use phone only because I'm on the road.
Okay.
The
same phone. Okay? What about you? What do you prefer to use?
The same. Face-to-face or mail.
Okay.
I really don't like phones, instant message.
When I want to do better communication, I mean, when it's, I want to be essential communication.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you don't do texting much?
I do all of them. I just say what I prefer.
Okay, because I see my kids and they seem to not be able to not text. It's like we'll be at dinner.
No, I think that.
And, you know, they're going to stop in the middle of a sentence to text.
Personally, I prefer video conferencing and telephone because it's more direct. It's a bit. Like
so you prefer.
Face-to-face,
what you call synchronous communication, talking live, than asynchronous. Okay?
I think email is also very, very, very useful because we have traces.
Yes.
What do we have talked? What are we going to do? What we have to have.
Okay. Now, how many emails do you get per day that is non-spam?
I have perfect filters. Not spam.
Yeah, no, you're not here. You're.
Control filter.
Yeah, do you mean not like.
Do you mean in your Steam mailing list? Is that spam or not?
Mail that you.
Are interested in.
That you read and that are. You know, and are.
Yeah. I would say two or three.
Two or three per day.
For the university.
No. The whole in your inbox.
Okay. Five.
Five.
20, 30.
5 to 10. I received like 10, but I read 5 of them, so it's more around 5.
Okay.
Yeah, I
envy you. I envy you. So this is the emails I've received today. Well, there are a few spam that I haven't had time to filter but this is already what I got today. This is what I got yesterday. Okay. So I don't know how many emails that
is.
No. This is email that is. That I need to keep and look at, and so that's how many? 114. So life gets different. And I wish I had 10 messages that I need to act on each day.
So anyway, the point today is not really to talk about email so much. But it's true that email has become really a very massive way of communication. And what you have in this list is two things that are essentially what we call asynchronous or different time, which is the physical mail. When is the last time you put a stamp on the letter and wrote to your grandmother or something?
I buy crystal paper.
Okay, when is the last time you put a letter in the mailbox with something you wrote yourself, not like a form you had to send or something?
Was it form?
I don't remember.
Yes, it was.
Anyway, but it still exists, and email. The other thing, face-to-face, telephone, certainly video conferencing, are we real-time? What we call real-time. And then you have instant messaging or texting, where it is real time, but it's okay if the other person is not immediately there or does not reply immediately, because so you can have it's sort of in between the real time have to be there and may take several days. Are there other things that I haven't listed here that you use to communicate? We talked about social networks earlier, but nobody wants to admit there.
I also like not social networks in terms that they do not waste my time that much. As is that instant messaging, it really, you lose so much time if you allow people to send you all the time and stuff. But on Facebook, you can just publish something, and so I'm busy, and you're done.
Okay, so most of your communication is face-to-face, email, and like telephone or other means if you have to.
For one-way communication, we could add websites, wiki.
Yeah, although this is less communication. The wiki is more sharing documents. Okay, so just a little bit of history about the telephone, because I'm going to focus in this class today on real-time communication, and particularly that involving video. So the phone was invented in 1876, and very shortly after, people were starting to think, well, if we can ship sound over a wire, we ought to be able to do more and also do images. And in fact, the French person here, Dumoncel, presented something he was calling the telephote to the French Academy of Science in 1882. 1927 was the first television transmission in the US. So the first time you had an infrastructure to transmit live images. And here we see the AT&T president talking to the Secretary of Commerce, Hoover, in 1927, when this thing was first out. So, all in all, this is all very young. It's essentially less than a century old. I talked last time a little bit about picture film, which was introduced at the World's Fair in 1964, turned to a product a few years later, and the product was a massive failure. So, survey results indicated that most people did not like picture phone. The equipment was too bulky, the controls were awkward, and the picture was small. So it was failing on all aspects of usability of the thing. In France, I think it was in the 80s, they did an experiment in Biarritz, which was the first city in France to have optical cabling. And so a bunch of people were given video phones. And it was the same thing, it was a failure. People didn't like it. And do you know why? You see why? So when you use the phone, there are two, if you talk about phones being in your home, what do? You talk to other people, and some are close people, your family or friends, and sometimes you have to make phone calls to people you don't know. Now the problem that arises is that if you are talking to very, very close friends or close family, it's okay if they see you and you're not, you're still in your bathrobe or the image is revealing a lot more than the voice. Also, you have to pay attention. Sometimes you're on the phone and there's you're doing something else. You can't do that on video phone. And when you talk to strangers, it's even worse. I mean, sending your image is something very intimate. And in fact, there are cultures where they don't even like the fact that your image can be captured by technology. So I think it was a failure. Here is mostly put in terms of technical limitations, but I don't think that was really the real reason. I think once you have the technology working, you have to be careful at what you do with video communication. So last week we saw this scene from 2001, Space Odyssey, where his father is calling his daughter. But interestingly, I mean, this thing is, has not caught up. Today we have the technology for doing this. The one thing that people start to use is things like Skype. Now, you were mentioning, were you mentioning you use Skype?
Yeah.
Now, who do you, if I may ask, who do you Skype with? Is it, you know, people you don't know, or people you know, or people close to you?
Well, people I know, like my dad and relatives.
Right. So people, you know, from your family.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't occur to you that, you know, if you were to have to call someone to, I don't know, order a pizza or something, you would need to have to see them.
You can still give audio call simply.
Yeah.
Like phone call.
Yeah. Okay. And so the point here is that there is this notion that telephone was this great invention so you could speak to people at a distance, and therefore a video phone should be better. And everything that's been done has been showing that it's not that simple, it's not that easy. Now, one area where there were great hopes was to bring this into the professional world, and that gave rise to video conferencing rooms. And you know, today you can buy for $500,000 to $1 million or euros, depending on where you are, a room like this, where you have, here it's three big screens where people appear at life size. On this side we have a nice table with nice chairs, and you sit down, and you can have what's called mostly eye contact, so when I look at you, you see that I'm looking at you. Very nice audio that is spatialized, so if I'm sitting there and this person is speaking, I will hear it from my right, and things like this. Again, it hasn't been a successful business. They, companies like Polycom and a couple of others do sell these things, but to, you know, typically big companies, their CEO, they like to have one fancy room like this, but it hasn't gone down into the organization. And people still spend more time flying back and forth when they need to talk to people than use systems like this.
Why not Skype conference feature and a big screen? Why do we need that expensive room?
Well, that's a very good question. Because if you take Skype and you put it on a big screen, all sorts of technical problems arise. First, sound is terrible. I have yet to have a Skype call where it goes fine from one to the other.
I mean,
we get echo, the thing gets off. The, well, yes, but that's, you know.
They can have really good connection of the one we have in our. For example, when I was at Ibria, all the conferencing videos was with Skype as a big screen, and everything worked perfectly. They pay a bit more, it's not the. You pay some stuff in Skype, but...
Ah, yeah, well, if you pay,
but
you
it's really
the service.
Cheap, I mean, that's...
But it's not the only thing. So sound is a problem that is not easy, especially when you go several people to several people. One-to-one, you can wear headphones, and that solves the echo problem and the feedback problem. Other big problem is eye contact. We are wired, our brains are wired to recognize faces and to recognize... eyes. What happens in a typical setting is we have here a view from the top where we have Mr. Blue and Mr. Yellow. So Mr. Yellow has his camera above the screen, and so Mr. Blue can see him slightly from above.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if Mr. Yellow is the boss, it's very different than if Mr. Blue is the boss. You know, when you look down onto someone, if it's higher in the hierarchy, it looks weird. Mr. Blue has put his camera on his side. That's even worse because it looks like an angle. Like, you know, I'm not really looking at you. So eye contact is a very critical aspect of video communication. What these systems do is they get to great lengths to try to improve eye contact. So here they have three cameras right above. And because you're far away enough, you don't see, I mean, the apparent distance is smaller, but when you are on your laptop, having the camera offset relative to the image really means that
either I look at the image and you see me looking down at your belly or something, or I have to look in the camera and then I don't see you.
So this is the kind of things that people have worked on a lot. And for example, in the 90s, they created this video tunnel to solve the problem of eye contact. Now, to have real eye contact, what you want is to have the camera in the position of the eyes of the person that is displayed on the screen. So if I look at the eyes of the person, I'm looking at the camera, and the person on the other side will see me looking at her. So the way to do this is you take a screen. Of course, I cannot put the camera behind the screen because the screen is not transparent, although people have tried that too. But here it was done with a half silver mirror. So half of the light that's here goes through, and the other half is reflected from above, and the camera was put above with the second mirror there. So by looking here, it's as if the camera were here. And that gives a completely different experience. You really feel like you can look people in the eye. Now the other thing is, in the real world, our eyes are not fixed in the world. They move in the head moves, my body moves, I'm constantly moving. And as I move, I change my view on the world. Now, when I'm on the screen through video conferencing, this does not happen. What I see is what is being captured by the remote camera. And usually it's a steady image. And you know, with Skype, typically you have this picture-in-picture, so you can see what the other sees, so you adjust the video. But still, you don't have control over the video you're looking through. So Bill Gaber in 95 did a system called the video window, where the camera was mounted on a robotic arm, and he had a system to track the head position. So the camera at the distance was duplicating the movement of my head. So when I went right, the camera went right. If I turned my head, the camera would turn, and I had sort of a remote presence. And that allowed me to shift my attention from one person to the other. Now, the thing was pretty spooky because it was this big robotic thing in front of you that was turning. And but again, it gave a different sense of, I would say, immersion or telepresence of being in the remote space, as opposed, what you get through the system is the impression that you're looking through someone else's eyes, as opposed to looking directly. Now, when you have a one-to-one situation, things are already hard enough because of these two problems, but you can sort of make it work. When you have multiple people, and many of these video conferencing systems were designed to have a group of people on one side and a group of people on the other side. Now, when you have two groups of people, it's not just, you know, two cameras that you need. You need one camera per person plus one screen per person. So there's no easy way to solve this. People have tried various approaches. This is one of the earliest ones, 92, the Hydras, where they built three little devices like this. They each have arguably a very small screen. They have their own camera. And you would put them on the table in a way that is consistent among the different sites. The thing is that this person here is seeing him through that camera. So when the person here is shifting his attention to the Hydra on the right, this person on the left will see him turn his head, as he would in real life, while this other person on the right will see him sort of focus on him. And if you put the things consistently at all sides, you get something that's more consistent with the real life. Now, getting all of these things together right is really complicated. And today, the way that this is being solved is by building these fancy, expensive rooms where you control the position of the cameras, you control the position of people, so you know where they are. You put an array of microphones so you can
to capture specialized audio, and that costs a lot of money. The other thing they do when they build these rooms is they come in, they usually paint the room, they put their own lighting, because the other thing is you don't want to look bad on camera, and because of video cameras don't capture images the way the eyes do, you can look really like you're a living dead. Or So they are very careful about doing proper lighting. If you're lighting from the top, like we have here, you will get shadows that will make you look tired and angry. And so they do a lot of work on the lighting as well. And the thing ends up looking more like a TV studio than a room. But I tried several of the systems. This one is actually the better one. But most systems, if you're sitting, it's fine. And then you stand up. And because of the way the cameras are positioned, you're cut here, your head disappears. And so the other people stop seeing you. And you're not aware that they're not seeing you because you don't get feedback. So the thing is, there were great hopes. There was lots of money put into developing these rooms, but I don't think they were really solving the right problems. They were solving a problem for a very small market of, you know, like CEO to CEO, big guys talk, and things like this. But not everyday use in companies where people have to meet often. Because when you have a meeting, a physical meeting, well, there's a formal part where people are sitting and things are very formalized. But then the before and after, people, you know, chat, and there's all these other aspects of human communication that these systems don't support. And so, you know, moving this video conferencing technology to the desktop to make it available to more people has been tried for many, many years. This is an early system in 97. This is NetMeeting. This is iChat. iChat, I think, is interesting because they have this kind of staging. But because there is only one camera, you have this problem that you don't know who's looking at what. And the other thing is that, well, the interface for iChat is pretty lean and mean, like Apple tends to do. But when you look at that meeting or this, or even recent systems, they tend to be very complicated. If you have a system that allows you not just to do video, but to share slides or to do something else, it takes half an hour to get the thing together. And so that's another aspect relative to what I was saying before, that if you don't have smooth transitions from one mode to the next, if you don't have an easy way to bring someone into the conversation, it's not going to work. Because in real life, we are not used to having to, you know, actively deal with technology to talk to people. You know, I'll talk to you, I'll come to you, I talk. I don't have to push buttons or do anything. And so the system should have much less viscosity in terms of user interface. But I think a deeper even problem is that all the systems were designed to support synchronous, mostly one-to-one. Even in the video conferencing room, it's much better if you're in the center than if you're on the sides. So mostly one-to-one conversation with a beginning and an end. All these conferencing rooms or conferencing systems, you had to book them in advance, and the meeting is from 2 to 3, and at 3, if we're not done, well, the thing's going to cut off because it's expensive, and things like this. The phone is also like this. In order to talk to you, I have to, you know, interrupt you. And the phone rings, and then you have to make a decision. And there are interesting cultural differences. In France, it's very rude to not answer the phone. In the US, it's very rude to answer the phone. If I'm talking to someone in my office, the phone rings, if I pick up the phone, this is really rude. In France, it would be considered the opposite. If the phone rings, and you're talking to someone in your office, the person is going to stop talking and say, well, you're not picking the phone? I mean, so people have, you know, different ways to adapt to this kind of interruption, because it's not a natural way to engage in conversation. Now, the thing is, why do people need to communicate at a distance? Well, you know, there is one aspect where it's just about chatting and giving each other news. And the reason I think Skype and iChat are used for family type of conversations, like you were describing, is because this is what you do. It's like, you know, okay, how are you doing? And it's nice to see the other, like you'll be sitting together in the living room. But then there are all the other uses where it's not just about communicating. If it is communicating, it's about something we're doing together. So many of the systems, in fact, were unaware that people were working on stuff. And so things like sharing slides was a feature that was added as an afterthought to many of these conferencing systems. I
saw one of these fancy rooms here,
very nicely finished, and then they added this screen to the side to put the slides on. In another case, there was a screen that had been added underneath here, and it must have been very weird, because if you're sitting there and you're leaning over the table to look, you know, at the other people's feet in order to see the slide, it must be very awkward for the other side. And so this was typically an afterthought to add this shared artifact that is the slideshow. And so I think the systems are really not just about communication. They also need to support working on shared artifacts, shared documents. But then, if we get back to this notion of, you know, why do people communicate together? Well, there's the chatting, but there's more than that. And especially if you think of people who are close friends or family or say a couple that has to live apart for a period of time because, you know, they have different jobs or something. What you want is not to just call someone to talk and then we're done. You want to stay in touch. You want to have an open channel as if we were living in the same environment. You know that when you live at home, whether it's with your wife and kids or with your parents or with the person you're sharing your life with, you don't have to communicate all the time to know that the other person is there. You know, one can be, you know, in one part of the room, the other one can be the other, and you have this peripheral awareness of what the other is doing. You know whether the other person is busy or not, if you can interrupt or not. You know if the other person is upset or not. So there's all these very, very subtle cues about the emotional state, the presence of the other person, and none of this technology were designed for that.
We do that with my friends.
Yes.
Leaving the Skype open, even if we don't communicate.
Yeah.
And we have the sense somehow that we started together with the Skype.
Yeah.
We try to. Yeah.
And so what I will do now is look first at systems that have supported communication while sharing artifacts, and then we look at systems that have been created to support this notion of shared awareness and this kind of open channel you were mentioning.
Okay, so first, communication about shared documents.
So again, this is not something that's new. We saw in the intro class, those who could attend it, this video from Doug Engelbart in 1968, where they are editing shared documents and they can bring audio and video communication overlaid on top of the documents they were editing. So this is not a new idea, and not only not a new idea, but it's not new. It's been done for a long time. Now, more recently, there was a lot of work in this area in the 90s. The first that I think is directly relevant is Video Draw by Tang, John Tang and Scott Miniman from, guess where, New York Spark. And this was a very simple system where you had two drawing surfaces, really you draw with real pens, a camera, and the surface would be semi-transparent so you could project from behind the image from the other camera. So what happens? I am drawing, but I also see what the other is drawing. I also see the other person's hand as it is doing the drawing.
I have, I believe, a video here. Is that video whiteboard? Well, that's Videodrome, yes. So here one user is doing a tic-tac-toe game, is starting to play, and that the image of the hand of the other user. Very simple. And that's something more complicated, where people are designing together the interface for some application. And you see this is the version we are on the side of writing stuff. But before, we saw the other person writing there. So it's a very simple physical setup, but quite efficient. Here we see the hand of the other person. Now, of course, when you're seeing this as a third person, it's weird to have two right hands and things like this. But when you are the one acting, it's clear which is yours and which is someone else's. It's also nice because it's an interface and there are not that many of them that could generalize to more than two people. So here's the kind of thing you can see. I'll put links to all these videos so you can look at them. So that was Videodraw, and then there was a whole series of variants in this. So Hiroshi Ishii, who was at the NTT, which was a Japanese telecom company at the time, did a kind of similar system with a camera showing your hands and mouse and video of the other person, which you didn't have in the previous system, and that added some better ways of communication. And then the next year, Tang and Niemann came back with the video whiteboard, where here they went to full size. And so instead of a flat, it was a vertical, instead of horizontal, it was vertical drawing surface. Same typical setup, except the video camera was behind the screen and it would capture the shadow of the other person. And so I think I have a video of that as well. Here it is. And so it's a different sense of presence because you feel the other person behind the screen. Even though it could be, I mean, in that case, it was done with analog video, and so the person was not far away. But you get a different awareness of what the other is doing rather when you have just the hands. Okay, but again, same general concept. Now, then we get to what I think has been the best system built so far in that space. And that's called Clearboard, and it was done by Hiroshi Ishii in 92. What they did to design the system is they did some mock-up where they had people sitting on both sides of a transparent piece of glass and drawing things. Here you do a lot of writing, but of course if I write something it's going to look unreadable from the other side. But they were testing this notion of, you know, let's share the surface while we can see each other. And one thing that they emphasized here is the importance of eye contact, which we talked about. Every time you communicate with people, you do eye contact. If I speak to you without looking at you, it's embarrassing or awkward. So eye contact was important, so you needed eye contact. But there's more than that. There's also what he calls gaze awareness, knowing where the other is looking. So I can look at you, but you're looking somewhere else, but I know you're looking there. And then I can look at where you're looking at because it's focusing my attention. So it built a system called the Clearboard that does exactly that. There's a sheet here with an interactive drawing program. And you see the person, I guess we see better here, and that's not a reflection of him, even though they look alike. But this one has glasses and this one doesn't. So here is the image of the other person. Now, that is something that I find fascinating, and I haven't seen a proper study of it. The amazing thing is that if I put this drawing and I mix it with the video image of the other person, my eyes are able to either focus on the drawing or focus on the other person's image
and there's no problem. Now, this works if I'm doing a line drawing here. If I were displaying photos, it would be different, presumably. But the eye has this amazing capacity of distinguishing between these two layers, even though they are really, it's not a question of focusing, like one is in distance and the other is close up, which you can do with what's called vergence, converging on one plane or the other. Here it's the same plane, and still you can do this distinction.
It's a hard possibility, the other person is moving. You can separate planes if one is moving.
So it's obvious that motion plays a big factor, and you move all the time.
You compensate for missing pixels.
So, but I think there's a phenomenon here that would deserve more in-depth study to understand really what's going on. Now, the system was not easy to build. The ones we saw before was just, you know, cameras and projectors hooked up together, and that was it. Here, they have a half-sphere mirror on top, so the camera is above to capture the image as if it were behind the screen. There's a projector doing back projection. There is a digitizer sheet so it can capture what you're drawing. All of this is eating light, so it had to be in the dark. And then there were both a video network to exchange the video signals, plus the layer of the drawing program that needed to be superimposed. So fairly complex system to build. I have some video here, I think. Where did it go? Clipboard. So this was...
...cannot erase the partner's drawing. Erasing the marks is also burdensome. Especially
I hate the commentary here. So here this is Clipboard 1. It's a version where it's you draw physically on the sheet of paper, and so you're not really sharing an electronic drawing. In the next version, that's Clipboard 2. That's the good one. Okay. So what's he saying?
To overlay the face images with a special video overlay board. The mixed RGB video image is projected onto the screen's rear surface.
Okay, well, let's show it in action, see it in action.
And the drawing marks easier to see. The screen size is 1.7 times bigger than that of Clipboard 1.
Sorry, I can't listen to this guy. It's just 20 minutes. So... I don't know how much you see here, it's always hard to see videos and the cursor is in the middle. So that's the effect you have, is you see the other person sort of behind the glass, and you can share this interactive drawing in these documents. I haven't had a chance to use the system myself, but we've played with things with this camera, and then the notion of eye contact and gaze awareness are really strong. It's really interesting. He can look at one part of the drawing and instantly I don't realize that I'm looking where he's looking. So we have, and they made studies where they were quantifying the amount of time that people make eye contact versus follow gaze awareness and or on the contrary, just focus on the drawing. Now, of course, this one is so it would be harder to imagine generalized to more than two people.
Sorry, insisting on that, but what if the image was animated? They still will not get interrupted from each other? I mean, maybe the reason they do not have a problem to distinguish between the person and the image is because the one is animated and the other one is stable.
I think there's this aspect. There's also the aspect that it's a line drawing versus a photographic image. I'm sure there are cases where it wouldn't work well. But I think it's interesting that there are cases where it works well. And so it'll be interesting to understand more when it does work or not. We've done some work at our lab where we overlay different images, and instead of doing just transparency, playing with the level of transparency, we look at the contrast in the image. So when there's more contrast, local contrast, we make one image less transparent. And we get better effect than the pure transparency that they had here.
And I think there's something that needs to be studied further here. It's not...
an article about window managers, right?
I'm sorry?
What you're talking about is window managers and how to show that the window is in front. I read something from your lab.
Well, we've worked on window managers. I have no. Oh yeah, I'm zoomed in. Sorry.
There were different effects: transparency and desaturation.
Yes.
Patrick Bodish did a work like on this, on different ways of mixing images using the content of the two image to control the merge. And I mean that's something, you know, if you're interested in that. Some scene, probably room to make an internship or something to study stuff around this, because we're as I've explained before, I think we have, when we're presenting the internships, we have this large wall display at the lab, and we're building another one, and we're also working with the cave that they have at LIMSI, and we want to study collaborative work across these environments. And so one of the things we want to do once we have the equipment is to, you know, see how should we mix the thing that people are working on with the images of the other people. So do we want to do sort of something like this? Do we want to have separate screens where you see the other people and where you share the work? And I think neither of this is going to really work, and we'll probably have to invent some new ways to see, to sort of stage the other person in the context of the shared work. So that's
An exciting project if you're interested. Now,
there has been, in fact, other interesting work after that. So this is 98 Hypermirror. And I think that's clever. What it does is there's a camera in front of the participant here, and the participant is on a, say, a blue screen background. So you can extract the shape of the person from the background, and then that image is superimposed with the image from the other side. So it's like you are in the, you see yourself in the mirror, but in a different environment. And so what they, so here it's not immediately obvious, but you know they're doing a virtual handshake because this person can see herself. I don't know if you know the Sony iToy or more recently the Kinect, but the iToy was the first game that was using a video camera. And what you do, what you did is you could see yourself, same ideas we've seen before, sort of kind of in the background. And the way to activate buttons in this game interface was to wave the hand on top of the button. And because you see yourself, you have this instant loop where you can perfectly control your gestures and adjust to the scene you are in, virtually, by seeing yourself. And so I think this is what they did here in Hypermirror, and it works, I think it works really well.
I think I have a short video of that as well. That was Clearboard. Where is it? I had the Hydras. Oh, maybe not. Oh, here it is. Okay, so this is what the video is capturing. I guess you're doing origami. Can we see the other side, please? No. I didn't cue that very cleverly. So she's showing a map. And we're going to see the other person anytime. Yeah, so that's the other person there, and he can show things on the map. So I think that's the same idea here. No, I think it's a very clever idea. And you know, next time you'll have a class on avatars, and I think it would be interesting to see this notion of whether it's better to represent yourself in the system as a synthetic shape, or whether taking your real life image and projecting it into the space is not in fact also very powerful.
There is a slightly issue with eye direction, with the gaze direction.
Yes.
Because you are looking on the screen, so it's reversed.
Yeah. Now, it's something I didn't mention about ClearBoard. In ClearBoard, you could write your image was reversed for the other side. And that's something that people, in fact, didn't really notice. So that if I draw and I write hello, since it's captured like from behind, they had to reverse the origin, the image horizontally, so it's consistent on the other side. So it's interesting that I hadn't thought about the eye gaze for this one, so I'd have to think, but there's no reason why you couldn't...
you could put the camera behind, and you would have to shut down the screen for a short amount of time, taking a picture and turn it on again.
Yeah, that's interesting. Interesting point. I'll have to think about it. Okay, so I think this series of work really are interesting, and it's kind of sad that none of the current tools we have today allow to do this kind of merging of the stuff you're working on with the video conferencing. Because you know, when you're in Skype, or when you're in Google Hangouts, or when you're in iChat, it's an application that's completely independent of whatever else you're doing. So you can put a Google Docs document that you're sharing with the person with whom you're talking over Skype, but these things are completely disconnected, so I cannot do this kind of merging. And the thing is, video images take room on the screen, so having them side by side means you having smaller space to operate. And it's also a case that all the things we've seen were between 1990 and 2000. And since then, frankly, I haven't seen much work in this space. The funny thing is that a lot of these systems were done with analog video, which was a pain to work with, or sometimes digital video, but on a dedicated local network. Now, you know, we can do video on the internet fairly decently, and so we have much better technology to support these things, but the work has stopped, so it's a little bit of a mystery to me. Now, the second thing I want to talk about is this notion of using video to support shared awareness. I talked about this in the first class. This is the hole in space, and to me, it's a very good illustration of the ability that humans have, and I'm sure animals as well, to recognize, to identify the ability to communicate with other people. So this was a holding space experiment, which was a three-day event that took place in 1980, where the storefront in the Lincoln Center for the Arts in New York and the Center City in Los Angeles. So in two storefronts, without any advertisement, there was a large wall display here with a camera and microphone that were picking the sound outside, and loudspeakers, and they were hooked together for 3 days, night and day. And without any advertisement of whatever it was, people instantly went in front of this, realized they could talk to the people on the other side, realized, you know, they were in Los Angeles and New York, and then very quickly they started to organize a gathering to meet with friends and family and things like this. And it's sad that I haven't been able to find any video of this. In fact, it seems to be only two photos that are still floating around. But it illustrates this notion that when you put video, people immediately recognize it. And the idea here is that you can use video not only to support formal communication, but also to support and probably encourage informal communication. So formal communication is where most of the work has been done. It's what these video conferencing rooms are for. It's stuff that is planned in advance, it has an agenda, we're going to do this and that, and we're going to be done at 3 o'clock, there's a list of participants, you're invited. It's very structured. But most of the communication we have is informal, it is unplanned, it is spontaneous. It is open. You know, I run in a corridor, I see someone in the office say, oh, I wanted to tell you this. And then we start chatting, and then someone else comes by and say, hey, how are you? And then we talk about something else. So it's really a very important aspect to communication, also to coordination. And it's not supported by systems today. Now, of course, a lot of the time, both things coexist. So if you're in a work environment, you have meetings that are organized, but there's also this informal things that happen as you walk down the hall and you see someone is there. So how do we support the things? So there was this experiment, and that was in the same time period as what I was describing before. In fact, most of it was in the same locations. On media spaces. So the term media space was coined by Stultz and Harrison in the 1985 paper, where they built this situation where a research group from Xerox PARC was split in two halves. One half was sent to Portland, Oregon, and in between the two spaces, both of which were offices around the central place, and in the central place, they put a large screen with a camera and, again, audio link with the other space. So everybody, most people from their office could see this through the wall window of their office, and they could come and sit down here in the couches and talk to the other side. And so what they wanted to study is what happens when you put this constantly open video, audio video link between two spaces, we link the two spaces together, and we put a group who's been used, know each other, who's worked together before, and who's continuing to work in this environment. I think that's very interesting is that it changes, it's not really seen as a communication system where you know you go there to do this or that. It becomes part of the environment. That's why they call it media space. It's a space. You know, we're in a room, we're aware we're in a room, but we don't pay attention, it's there. And that was the same sense there. There are even examples where people didn't really know where the other persons were. I mean, of course, they know intellectually because they know who's in which part of the group, but one people could be sitting in the couch, and then on the other side, we see someone walking by, say, have you seen X? And then the person, the remote end, would say, oh, yes, he was there 5 minutes ago. And this was done, and I don't have video clips, but the ones I've seen, it was so spontaneous that it clearly showed they had lost the sense that they were in separate space. Yeah. And I can believe that because I did a sabbatical in 1992 in Toronto, and there was a lot of work on these media spaces at the time, and then I came back to France. And I, so we had, well, this is what I'm going to talk about now, but just to finish on this, so I lived for a couple of years with a video link in my office with another office or other people in my group. And it really felt that we were sort of sharing the space and being in the same large office. Now, the thing is that it's all nice and good, but mediated communication is never going to be like communication. There was a very interesting study done by Fish in the 1990 called Video Window, where they set up a lab with a room divided in half with a window in the middle and microphones so people could hear and talk to each other. And they studied, they put people, you know, in both sides, and they were just looking at how people behave. They analyzed over 160 hours of video recordings of these meetings. And what they observed is that there are fewer conversations across the wall. People find it harder to reciprocate, to react to someone. They were few, if any, side conversations. Because you felt like everything you said was heard by everybody else. And the system didn't... Even the system had eye contact, it was just a glass in the middle of the wall. They felt like, you know, it was harder to stay in touch. So we know that, you know, mediated video communication is not the real thing. But yet, all the people who worked on media spaces at the time, and there were a number of them, have had this experience of it being very different from a conferencing system, even from a video conferencing system. And yes, you can fire Skype and then going all day long. My experience is it's not exactly the same. So these are a number of media spaces that were built in the 90s. Video Window and Cruiser, Ray and Casmer, like Xerox, I created, in fact, the user interface for Casmer. I spent a year at Toronto where they were working KiffCat, Argo and Sun, at DEC and the Montage at Sun were things that were using digital video, which at the time was really hard. And then a number of places, including us here, created some of these systems. And the thing is that we were really our own subjects. We were living in these media spaces. And if I remember coming back from Toronto after spending several months there, in their media space. You don't use a media space, you are in the media space, literally. And I came back here, and I came back to an office where I was alone in my office, and I was, like, lonely. And I remember spending my time, you know, working for 5 minutes, say, oh, I'm gonna see what they're doing next door. And then we installed the media space, which was an analog video, like all of these, most of these were, which was an interesting thing in itself, and then having this window to the other office really established the link. Now, a couple of important features. What we were doing was to have a separate device for the video communication. So it was not in the computer. Well, it couldn't really because we were using analog at the time, so it didn't go in the computer. But retrospectively, having a separate screen, the camera on top of the screen and the loudspeakers next to it, meant that one, it was not using my screen space, which I need for the work I'm doing. But it also means that people looking at me could tell whether I was working at the computer or if I were talking to them. So this spatial arrangement really made it more clear what the other is doing. Another thing is there were a number of services. So it was not just we establish a link and we stay on, which requires some coordination, right? Or some interruption. I'm calling you on Skype, and you don't know why you're being called. Is it just to say hi? So the system and the user interface to the systems were providing multiple services that were really communication-oriented. Well, not communication-oriented like the telephone, but more than that. So there was the mirror mode, so you can see yourself and see what others see when they look at you. There was a glance service. Glance is, you know, you're walking past the corridor, there's a door open, you peek and you say hi. So glance was a short, like 3 seconds, one-way video connection. And the person being glanced at had the sound playing, gling, you know, someone's come by and say hello. One rule in most of the system is that you want reciprocity. You don't want people to eavesdrop on you. And so the basic rule is that if I can see you, you can see me, right? And so the glance, in fact, unless you were in an ongoing call, the glance would be two-way, in some of the systems at least. Then there's a traditional video phone, I call you, you have to answer, and then we're talking. But that was not the most interesting one. There was the office chair, where people decide, we're going to establish this constant, always-on link between our two offices. Of course, if I want to glance at someone else, or if I want to do a video call, it will interrupt the office, and it will, depending on the various experiments, it will either blank what the other is seeing of me or not. And then there was this awareness view, which is this mosaic here, that would typically capture an image every few seconds or every minute of all the other offices in the media space and give me a sort of snapshot of what's going on. And it was very useful because typically you arrive in the morning while you look at the awareness view to see who's in there. This awareness view at the park was in fact shared between Xerox Park in Palo Alto, California, and Rank Xerox Europark in Cambridge, England, 9 hours apart. And typically, people who are leaving the lab late at night would run into those coming in early morning the next day in the other space. And so you would come in and say, who is here? And then you would do a quick glance at people who were here, because these images were not actually real time, so you know, a few people you want to say hi. And there was, in some version of the system, a way to quickly go from a glance to a call. So I glance at you, it's like, you know, I walk past the office, I say hi, and you say, oh, by the way, I wanted to talk to you. So there was this notion of transitioning from, I'm just, you know, saying hi, to, oh, I need to talk, and we go into a video call. Now, some people then develop other services, like collaborative services. This was done in Montage, I think, where in addition to the video, you could share slides and images and things. In Grenoble, they were doing these vision things where it was doing some filtering, so you would be caught picking your nose or things like this. So there was a lot of experiments about how can we support this kind of always-on video communication and this notion of living in the same space. And because you wanted to do more than just, you know, establishing an office chair or doing quick glances, a number of interfaces were developed to support this. This was an early version, which is a matrix view of who is connecting to whom. And so you can see the state, and you can only change your own line in the state. Although there was always a super user who could patch things. Then there were things that were a bit more usable, like simple buttons for the various services. This was the one that actually I developed. There was always a trade-off between the functions you want to make available and the fact that the user interface had to use as little space as possible. So this one was based on the door metaphor. And the idea is that you wanted to control your accessibility. I will get back to this in a second. So these are examples of systems that were developed. In Toronto in particular, where I spent some time in the Ontario Telepresence project, this system was used, but that was true also at Xerox Park, not only by the researchers involved in the project, but by other researchers from other groups, and also secretaries and staff. In Toronto, everybody was on the media space. And they even deployed it outside the lab at some point. Now, as I said, technically it was fun. This is a picture of the Toronto media space, probably around the time I was there. And this works. This works. And of course, when it stops working, that's where the trouble arises. So why is this massive cable? It's analog video, so you need to run analog cables from each camera, from each monitor, from each loudspeaker, from each microphone to a central switch. Now the switches that are switching video are different from those switching audio. They have limited capacity, typically 8, sometimes 16 channels, so you need switches hooked up to other switches.
I don't believe that. The technician is just messy.
And that is his real picture. I mean, I remember.
The person that the Gorkum that gave us, maybe they were not that organized themselves.
No, but you know, this is kind of thing where it looks messy, but it's not necessarily messy. And the cable is a cable. I mean, there's so much you can do. They, by definition, go from everywhere to everywhere, but things were pretty well labeled. And I know from knowing very well the person who was managing this that when something was going wrong, he was really good at finding
connection.
I like to say.
But to give you an idea.
He was this quiet.
Yes. Do not touch any of the wires. At Toronto, they had about 30 offices connected, and usually in each office you have more than one desk. At Park, it went to, I think, 50 or 60 offices connected together. And it was a lot of work to make it work, because then you need to also control the switches, and this was not really easy. Now, what did we learn from these studies? Well, the thing we learned is that people have various levels of engagement in the communication. You know, there were things supporting a background. You know, I want to be there, but that's it. So you would have public views on commons areas, and Europark, the top floor was a sort of cafeteria where you could get coffee at any time, and there were couches. People would gather there for lunch, and you could have a view. You could put on your monitor a view of that, which was a good way to see, you know, is it time to go for lunch? Are people gathering there? Office share was another type of background kind of communication where it was always on, but you were not always communicating with the other person. There were short focus calls like video phone and video conference, and then there are things that are lightweight interruptions, like lens. Now the problem is, the researchers involved in this were, you know, happy to test the system, so they didn't have much concern about things like privacy. As soon as you deploy this to people who don't understand the technology and these kind of things, they start to get worried about who's looking at me, how can I control this, how do I trust the system? And it's a very legitimate question. You know, once you put a camera in someone's office, it's like, okay, who controls what can be seen in this camera? What we did is we designed systems where there was an explicit way to turn the sound off with a physical switch, not something on your screen, which would have been easier for us, but a physical switch. And with the camera, we gave them a cap. You could put on the camera itself. Because that's the best way to tell people, well, if you block the lens of the camera, nobody's going to be able to look at it. And that was very important in getting this types of system accepted by the users. So one of the things we discovered is that it's really important to have symmetry. Because that's also an element of trust. If you tell people, the system is designed so that if you look at someone, the other person can see you. And vice versa. If someone looked at you, you will see who is looking at you. So if I can see you, you can see me. Then we want to give people control over accessibility. One way to do this is to have the users authorize every call. But that's not natural. I mean, if I'm in my office, I can't prevent people from saying hi when they walk by. Right? So I don't want every time someone is glancing at me, do you want to be glanced at by XYZ? No, that's not the point. What we want is a more selective accessibility, control. Well, right now I'm busy, I'm going to close my door, I'm going to put a sign, do not disturb, I'm here but I'm not here. Right? And so we did a lot of work on this selective accessibility, and this is the interface that was in Toronto. That inspired the one I did for Xerox, which was based on this notion of door. Now it's interesting because I don't think we have the same social code in France about the state of your door is really the level of accessibility that you have. At least at the time, I was surprised that people were using this heavily. So if the door is wide open, you know, you can come and interrupt me, and it's fine. If the door, so that meant for the system, glances are okay, and if you do a video call, it will connect immediately, I don't have to say yes. Then if the door is ajar, half open, you can still glance at me, it's okay, but for a video call I need to say yes. So, you know, if the door is ajar, you get by the door and you'd say, can I talk to you? That's the idea. If the door is closed, it means I'm kind of busy, I don't want to be glanced at because this is interrupting me. I may allow video calls. In some systems, it would be even on a person or a group, by group basis, and I need to okay them. And then the door locked means down coming. And so in one case, in the Bill Buxton's office, he actually linked the state of the virtual door to the state of the real door. He used a Macintosh mouse and did a clever hardware mechanical mount so that the position of the door would move the mouse, and by capturing the position of the mouse, it would link that to the state of the door. And so when he closed the door was closed. He wouldn't have to click on the button as he was closing physically his door. Now the thing is, this was very nice because it's a very simple model. Everybody understood it. And then there's a thing that happens. I said, oh yes, but you know, when my door is closed, of course it's not closed for my boss or so. And so people wanted to have systems with more flexibility of allowing access even more selectively than that. So we created this different door stays for different groups, and it's always too complicated. This is what I tried to do in this interface, and it didn't really work. People would not use it. People who used it didn't really always understand it. It was very hard to keep track of, you know, is my door open to you and close to it. It was just too complicated. And the really bad thing is that when someone new came in, and you send him in his office, and you told him where is the media space, and it's really cool, and he realized that because he was in nobody's group, he was locked out of everything. And that was really the opposite of what we were trying to do, where, you know, we wanted newcomers to feel like they're part of the group. So I think that the simple model, even though it has constraints, like a real door has, is probably the better one. But at least I wouldn't go for something sophisticated the way we did it. We need to find another way to do it if we need that.
Every person has its own communication coach.
Yes.
For example, in my case, when someone calls me and I don't answer, they know that it's always Lucario, so it doesn't mean that I am in the danger. A person that always answers his phone, it's a communication not to be able to answer. So I agree with that. Why do not let people have their own?
Yeah. And in fact, what we've seen all these communication technologies is that people develop their own social codes to say, well, you know, yes, my door is open, but I'm in fact busy and I can take this call. And it's something we should have built into this thing, because when you had a thing that says, do you allow the call, yes or no? In fact, in one of the systems, we had a thing where you could write why you can't answer at the moment. But it was still too heavy to have to type something. So maybe you should have been able to respond with a glance or some easy way to say, well, sorry, not now. But the thing we found is that people were developing these social protocols. And typically, you would never call someone without doing first a glance. Because if I do a glance and I see you're on the phone, I'm not going to disturb you. And so it was considered rude to do a video call without sort of announcing yourself before. And so, you know, a lot more could have been done and could still be done to better understand the social protocols. So to finish, because I realize it's noon, the thing is, media spaces really challenged the telephone model. And the telephone was invented. It's not something that's been there forever. Before the phone, there was no phone. And it was invented with a specific model, which is, you know, I interrupt you by calling you, you have to explicitly answer, and then you have a conversation that starts, and then we hang up, and it's over, and it's done. Human communication is not like that. Access to a person is negotiated. So, as I was saying, typically in the media space, you do first glance before saying, you know, well, the glance says, can I talk to you, or are you busy? And then you sometimes you would expect a reciprocation. So very often you would do a glance at one person, and that person would call you back immediately, saying, "Oh, I want to talk to you." It's very interesting if you look at the sociology of human communication and how people negotiate this in real life. So in our building we have these corridors, and when you walk in the corridor, you see someone at the other end. You have, you know, 10, 20 seconds to negotiate the approach. Am I going to look busy and rushing and I can talk to you? Or am I, like, you know, the coffee in my hand and say, how are you doing? And can we chat for 5 minutes? And what you find is that people in this approach phase, through their body language, they negotiate how they're going to interact. And some people are better than others at reading the signs, or, you know, it's not always perfect communication, but we negotiate as we do this approach. And this notion of approaching the conversation phase doesn't exist in most of the systems. I think we did some interesting work in media spaces, but there should be more of that. And you see the same thing with people, you know, sending a text message first before they call, or things like this. And again, this is social protocols to deal with the fact that the technology is not addressing this need very well. These communications could be very long. At the Xerox PARC, there were the famous case of two researchers sharing the office, so they were in two different offices, but had a constant connection for literally several years, and they couldn't live without. And sometimes you would go into the office of one of them, which was empty, and you would hear a voice saying, "Oh, she's gone to lunch," and that was the other person at the other end answering for her, this kind of thing, and it became, you know, a natural thing. The other thing is, we saw in the previous section that a lot of the things for sharing were really hard to generalize beyond two participants. Media spaces, I think, work well with more than two participants. We didn't do it, but we could do things like office share with more than two. It was more limited by the technology that we had than by the model itself, and I think that's a good thing. But the last point is that social aspects are really important. And in every of these cases where media spaces were deployed with real people, meaning not the researchers doing the research themselves, it required bringing the technology with the users actively involved in why are we doing this, how does it work, how are we going to use it, and being careful about social aspects. So when I was in Toronto, I remember a lot of the offices we had were windowless offices, which is something you don't see in Europe because there are laws against it, but in the US many people have office without outside windows, in Canada as well. And so Bill Buxton's secretary was in one of his offices without a window. And one day he comes in and says, "Hey, how would you like having a window in your office?" And so she looks at me like, "What?" So, well, here's the deal. I can, you know, I have this camera in my office that's looking out on the Toronto University main circle, and I can put a TV monitor in your office showing that image. So, you know, it's not a real window, but it's a virtual window. And she said, "Oh, yes, sure." And so, for several weeks, she had this monitor in her office doing one thing, showing the outside of Bill Buxton's office. And after a while, I said, well, this is very nice, but I see that everybody else is having you know, this screen as well. They can talk to each other. So, you know, can I have that as well? So, you know, he managed to have her ask for it rather than say, well, here is a camera, a microphone, and I'm putting this in your office. And it was a very clever way to, you know, get people accustomed to the technology and accept it. Okay, so I think, so the sad part of media spaces is that there was all this research that was done, but nobody is living in a media space anymore. And yes, we have Skype and Google Hangouts and iChat and others, but to me they're completely missing the mark. In that they're not addressing what people really want to do. They're addressing some needs, but they're completely missing some critical aspects. So why is that? I'm not sure. Maybe one element of answer to this is that we have been unable to show the value of media space in terms that are sort of recognized, such as, does it increase productivity? Does it make people work better, do better work? There's been a number of studies where people have looked at how people do things when they are face-to-face, when they are over the phone, when they are over you know, a chat system, and when they have video conferencing. And I don't know any study that has showed that video conferencing was significantly better than the other. However, that is true if you look at the quantitative analysis. Did they do the task faster? No. Did they do it better? Hard to say, but you know, there are some things that were done on scheduling things, and it was not if there was a gain, it was not big, so it didn't justify the investment to deploy this infrastructure. However, people, when you do the qualitative analysis, they liked it better. They feel more connected. The study on the scheduling exercise, you know, people would have to schedule a meeting among their agendas, and when people were either face-to-face or through video conferencing or media space type of video communication, they felt like they were more happy about the results. If you do it over email or over other technical means, you may get to a solution that is technically as good in terms of minimizing conflicts, but people who felt frustrated. If they could see each other and talk to each other more naturally, they would feel happier about the result. And so it's very hard to sell a technology and expensive investment if you say, oh, it will just make people feel better. You know, in our time and day, it's not really what companies are looking for. I think it's short-sighted, because I think if people are, you know, feeling that they work better, they will work more in the long run, or they will become more productive. In fact, something that you know, having spent some time in the U.S., you always hear these comments that the French are lazy and have 7 weeks of vacation and they work 35 hours a week and all that. The thing they don't want to know is that the hourly productivity in France is way higher than the US. And it is because, yes, when we go to lunch, we go to lunch. We don't, you know, eat lunch when someone is giving a talk and we're doing our email, which is what you do there, where you're always on. We take a break and you come back to work and you're more relaxed and more effective. So the overall productivity in France is a bit lower than the US. But I think with a better quality of life, because when we work more effectively. And I think it's even more the case in Scandinavia, where I spent some time as well. And so you have to look at all these aspects, right? I think there's one last slide here before I stop. I'll do the last section on the next class. No, in fact, that's the intro slide to the next thing. So I'll stop here for media spaces. And
yeah, by the way, I found a video of Owen Space on YouTube.
Okay, well, you have to send me the link. Okay.
It's called the mother of all video chat.
Because I actually tried yesterday quickly, I must say. Because I know I had tried a couple of years ago, I didn't find anything. And yesterday I did, you know, Hole in Space, and the name of the author is Rabinowitz, and I didn't find anything. But I'm not a good Googler, so.
I just searched Hole in Space 1980.
Really?
And then clicked on videos and what was
it? I thought I did that. You have a better Google than I am. Well, thank you. Please send me the link. Any other questions?